suburban Eastern Australia, an environment that has, over time, evolved some extraordinarily unique groups of Homo sapiens. But today, we observe a small tribe akin to a group of meerkats that gather together atop a small mound to watch, question, and discuss the current events of their city, their country, and their world at large. Let's listen keenly and observe this group fondly known as the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Welcome back, dear listener. Yes, the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove podcast, talking about news and politics, sex and religion. We're here in, well, I'm in Brisbane, Australia. Scott is in Mackay, regional Queensland. Scott, how are you?
Good, thanks, Trevor. G'day, Joe. G'day, listeners. I hope everyone's well.
And Joe is with us, but our tech guy is having a technical problem, and beforehand his audio was a bit scratchy. So with fingers crossed, I say, Joe, how are you?
Hopefully that's fixed it.
No,
it's still
really
dodgy.
Yeah,
it's still dodgy. Tech guy Joe is going to just do his tech magic on his own audio, and we'll try and chime in from time to time, but don't know how much of Joe we're going to get in this episode while he sorts his stuff out. Anyway, we're going to talk about, well, we'll just catch up on some personal things. What are we grateful for? We're going to talk about the Sydney gay and lesbian Mardi Gras. Scott might have opinions on that. Spies, our spy agency was talking about a politician who's a spy, and then subsequently revealed that the spying group that he hadn't referred to was actually China. And a little bit about the departure on Scott Morrison and the religious sort of motivations behind a lot of what he did. And we have to talk about Gaza again. It just keeps going worse and worse. And a bit about Assange, a bit about Jim Chalmers and the Reserve Bank. And maybe we'll get time to do a little bit on this guy, George Galloway, who won a by-election in the UK. Did you guys get a chance to see any of the stuff around him?
No.
Right, okay.
Which seat was he running for? Was it Boris Johnson's old seat or not?
No, I don't know which. I can't remember the name of it, but I'm really interested in him because of just his rhetorical style in dealing with journalists.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the part that got me. A little bit like that guy who was the head of the union, the railway union. What was it, Mick something or other? And just the way he wouldn't take shit from people, particularly journalists, and would call out nonsense questions. And this guy has a similar style, which I find very refreshing. Now, he might be completely nuts on some issues, I'm not sure, but just
the sort of apparently.
Yeah, we got that, Joe, that he is apparently, but then we missed the other part that you said. Anyway, we'll persevere with things. Thank you to the people. Well, if you're watching on the live stream, you'll see that I'm not wearing glasses and Scott finding it difficult. Well, just unusual, because I've worn glasses since I was 16 and, yeah, got the intraocular lenses. So right eye was done on a Wednesday, left eye done on the Thursday, and I was certified to drive on the Friday. Scott, quite incredible, isn't it?
It is very bizarre. Yeah.
And I did drive to the Sunshine Coast on the Saturday and could see perfectly fine.
Mm. So are the lenses, they're man-made lenses, aren't they?
Yes, they're courtesy of Johnson & Johnson. Yes.
Okay, gotcha.
So, yep, they hold your eye open for about 15 minutes and cut the God-given lens out, Scott, and whack the jelly-like plastic one in there and off you go. So, anyway, it's so working
now,
well.
They're now permanently attached there or do they come out?
Yep, they're in there permanently.
Okay, so, gotcha.
Yeah, and very good for distance and okay for reading. And at the moment, the just sort of looking at the computer screen is probably the worst distance at the moment, but hopefully I've still got some improvement left in my eyesight as my brain and eyes work together. But for somebody who's had glasses since I was 16, like just these different things, every time I walk into the shower, I just go to reach for my glasses to put them on the sink. And going to bed at night or getting up in the morning, I reach for the glasses that aren't there and open the oven. I was cooking something the other night, opened the oven door, a lot of heat came out of the oven. I thought, well, this is going to fog up my glasses. And then, nope, because I wasn't wearing glasses. Mm. There's a whole range of different times where I've just automatically thought I have glasses on. Yeah, so very interesting. So anyway, I recommend it, dear listener, if you've got sort of cataracts happening. And yeah. Alison in the chat room says, congratulations on your new eyeballs. I remember when I got my eyes lasered 20 years ago and it was life-changing. There you go. So, yeah.
Brian's had his eyes lasered too. Mm. He now wears reading glasses.
Yep.
But, that's it.
Mm. That's amazing how many people have actually had it done when you start talking about it. So, So thank you to the people who sent messages wishing me a speedy recovery. I was very slack in not actually responding. But thank you, Mark and Paige and Anti-US Sentiment. And thank you, Paul from Canberra. And anybody else who I might have missed who sent a well wish, thank you. Yeah. So things we're grateful for. Now, dear listener, by the way, this podcast has chapters. So if you don't want to hear our little shenanigans about our personal life and stuff, on your podcast app, look for chapters and you can scoot past different topics and get into the meat of things straight away if you don't want to listen to the guff. But anyway, having said that, things we're grateful for. So on the PEP, the Planet Extra podcast, they kick off with a things they're grateful for segment, which I think is a useful thing to do. Watley's not so sure about it, but anyway, let's just give it a go. They mentioned archive.md. This is a website you've got to try if you want to get past paywalls on newspapers. So if you go to archive.md and type in the URL of an article from Sydney Morning Herald or The Australian or something like that that's behind a paywall, you'll get access to it. It's incredible.
Okay.
Don't know how long that's going to last, but this thing sort of pretends to be Google and gets in that way. That makes sense. So that's just been an interesting thing to use. And then in terms of things I'm grateful for, I would say anaesthetic, because I love it when I'm in some sort of day surgery or something and they start putting a needle in your arm and tell you you're going to be going to sleep. And it just is fantastic. I love a shot of anaesthetic. So, yeah, there you go. That's what I'm grateful for. Scott, anything that you're grateful for?
I was grateful that Nikki Haley kicked Trump's ass in the Washington, D.C. primary.
Did she?
Yeah. That was just reported this afternoon on by a new daily that I got.
Yeah. Is there something unusual about the Washington? Well, I guess no, the Washington.
It's just the Washington area. Yeah, they do hate Trump.
Right.
And so she kicked his ass in that. But, you know, like they said, you got to win 1,285 delegates. She's got 14 now. Yeah?
Right.
So, you know, I think Trump's going to win that.
Yeah. Yep. So, Scott, before we get on to just the recent events with the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras and the fact that the New South Wales police were asked not to march in the parade, I remember talking or hearing from somebody who was kind of pissed at the Mardi Gras as having been overtaken by oiled-up, muscly types of extravagant, over-the-top sort of gay and lesbian and queer community members. And it kind of overpowered, misrepresented, ignored the more low-key members of that community, who I think you would fall into the category of, Scott.
That category, you know, it's one of those things. I have never attended anything to do with the Mardi Gras or anything like that. I haven't been down for it or anything else. There was one time that me and Brian were heading down to Sydney and that sort of stuff. And I said, well, if we waited a week, we could go to Mardi Gras. Is there any interest? And he says, not really. So that's just our attitude. Now, you know, we're two old cis white gay men and that sort of stuff. We just don't. We don't like it. Well, it's not that we don't like it or anything like that. It's just not
your
scene. No, exactly. You know, I remember there was years and years ago, I was reading they had taken out the poet and that sort of stuff in Sydney that was a famous queer. Can't remember what his name was, but he was writing to one of his other lovers and he says, I don't see what a bunch of screaming queens parading up and down Oxford Street are going to do for our cause.
Right.
So anyway, having said that, it started off as a protest march and that sort of stuff. And those people in 1978 had a hell of a lot to be very pissed off about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were treated very badly by the cops and everything else. Now, the cops have recently apologized for the homophobic attitudes that were prevalent in the police force at the time. And they said that a lot of cases that went unsolved were because of homophobia and that sort of stuff, where they said, well, you know, it's just a pair of queers, don't worry about it, and that sort of thing. So it was a very disgusting time in our society. So that was the one thing where I thought to myself, okay, this is okay for the organisers to ask the police not to march in uniform. The second thing was the most recent event of that guy that was a copper and that sort of stuff that used his service weapon to...
Sorry, just backtrack. You're saying back in the day when it first started that the police were asked not to march in...
No, they were just recently asked not to march.
The recent event.
Yeah, right. They were just recently not asked to march in uniform, because in 78 they broke it up and that sort of stuff, and they met the protesters with trudgeons and that type of thing.
Yeah. So, dear listener, just for background, recently there was the arrest of serving officer Beaumont Lamar Condon over the alleged double murder of a missing Sydney gay couple. So, serving officer arrested over the double murder of a gay couple. So, that's what's happened in the last week or so.
Yeah, that was the second thing that happened the last week or so. I couldn't tell you what was the main... What was the main impetus behind the organising committee asking the police not to march?
Well, that was it. What was the other one? That was the only.
The other one was the apology that was handed out to people and that sort of stuff over the years of neglect and everything else from the police force.
Okay, I hadn't heard of that. I'm sure it was in response to this.
That doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me at all that was in response to that.
Yeah.
Now, I'm in two minds. I think the second thing was probably the least that they had to worry about and that sort of stuff. Like, you know, the copper shot those two and everything else because it was a love triangle that went wrong and he shot them both.
Mm. I mean,
but Brian said that one look at his social media would ring enough alarm bells to think to yourself that you wouldn't want him out as a copper. But anyway, it is what it is.
But, I mean, every community has its good and bad apples.
Of course we do, exactly. Yeah. And it's one of those things. That's why I just think to myself that, do I think that the cops should have been, do I think the cops should have been asked not to march? Not over that incident. Not over that incident.
I mean, what if a motorcyclist, you know, murdered a gay couple? Like, does everybody riding a motorcycle in, or you know?
Well, then you might have a problem with the dykes on bikes. Then you never know.
It's kind of like it's not like the police force encouraged in any way the murder.
No,
it's just by a member who was acting on their own. On their own, without representing the group at all. So, Joe, is the argument that the police were slack?
Yes.
And that's okay. But were they particularly slack because towards the gay community, to the LGBTIQ community, or were they just because, I mean, he could have murdered a heterosexual couple or something. Still having trouble with you, Jay, but we'll keep going. Anyway, they changed their minds, apparently. So the Mardi Gras organisers later reversed their decision and allowed police to march in plain clothes. Was what happened. So
yeah, I know. Which is, I would have thought that you'd want them there in uniform because the 78ers, who were the first in that first Mardi Gras, they had a hell of a lot to be very pissed off with the New South Wales police force because they came round whatever corner it is on Oxford Street, and they were there lined up across the streets and that sort of stuff with trudgeons, and they beat the shit out of them.
Mm.
You know, then when they were finally invited to march and that sort of stuff in uniform, the 78ers all gave them hugs and everything else when they came around the corner. So that was a very positive movement on behalf of the police and that sort of stuff.
Mm.
Which is why I think that it's No, I probably reversed my decision. I think the Mardi Gras committee should have never actually tried to ban them and that sort of stuff from marching.
Mm.
You know, I just think to myself that that one bad apple has tarnished the entire bunch.
Yes. Unless they've got some pretty strong evidence of systemic issues in the police force, then I think that was a poor decision, because you really want the police to be exhibiting to everybody that they're accepting of the LGBTIQ community and will treat them as equally as any other group. So short-sighted decision, I think, that one. But
I think it was very short-sighted.
Yeah. So that was that one. Spies, Scott. So the head of Asia.
They still won't name the bloke.
No.
So well, it could be either a guy or a girl. You never know.
Indeed. Could be. So the head of ASIO, Mike Burgess, has alleged that a former Australian politician, quote, sold out their country, party and former colleagues after being recruited by spies for a foreign regime. So that was the head of ASIO, but he refused to name who the politician was, and he said, most commonly they offer their targets consulting opportunities, promising to pay thousands of dollars for reports on Australian trade, politics, economics, foreign policy, defence and security. Don't we have a former Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, former Minister Pine, former Treasurer Joe Hockey, a lot of former guys who are working with other foreign governments and other foreign companies,
but they are actually
on Australian trade politics.
They are working with our allies. They're not actually working with China.
Yeah, well,
which is one of those things. I just think to myself that it's one of those things. Now, I at the time, you know, I've changed my mind on something else too. Now, I heard this on a podcast just recently. It was, I think, forget who it was.
You've changed your mind on naming this guy? Is that what you're saying?
No. This is something entirely different. No, this is something entirely different, because they were saying at the time on the podcast, they were saying that, yes, you want us not to actually go out there and consult and that sort of stuff. I understand why. But at the same time, you took away our lifetime pension, which is the only way a politician's ever going to make money is either from a lifetime pension or go out and consult somewhere.
Mm.
So they were actually saying that you've actually, if you're going to implement a ban on former politicians going into consulting, then you actually got to replace their income. Which did actually, it backed me into a corner. I thought, bastard, you've got me there.
Well, couldn't they work in an area unrelated to the portfolio they were in?
I don't think anyone would want to talk to them.
Careers and
I just don't think anyone would want them there, because they don't have any of the contacts or anything else that they're paying for.
But people are expected these days to change jobs regularly, and not just employers, but also the nature of their jobs. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the job people are doing in their 20s or 30s will be different in their 40s and different again in their 50s. Like, there's an expectation that everybody else sort of has career changes.
Mm.
It's not like they can't earn money doing something else, but just unrelated to the portfolio they were in. I don't think, if they're worth their salt, they should be able to get a job somewhere doing something.
Yeah, one would have thought so.
So you could be a defence minister and go and work in some sort of other capacity in the economy besides defence, surely.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's just one of those things. It's just one of those things that made me examine my own thoughts and that sort of stuff on it. Yeah. Anyway.
Suppose if you've been shuffled around in the government, then there's going to be a limited number of places that you can go that you haven't worked in.
But you pick up skills in being in government.
In management.
In management.
No, what I'm saying is, if you've been Minister for Education and they got shuffled into Defence Ministry and then shuffled into, you know,
Yeah, but I think what we're actually saying is, you've got this problem with this revolving door. Like, Pine's probably the most recent example, who left the government as a defence minister and then popped up on a board and that sort of stuff for some yank defence.
Yeah, him and Joe Hockey and all the rest are all lining up companies to get on the gravy train with the whole AUKUS deal because there's money to be made. And look, maybe for ministers, why not? Give ministers a lifetime pension and say to keep them happy, whatever it takes. But
a lifetime superannuation. That would be screw up the economy, they're as screwed as the rest of us.
Yeah, right. And what do you think of whether he should have named the politician involved, Scott?
I think it's very amusing right now sitting there watching them tear each other apart over it and that sort of stuff. Like, you've had Malcolm Turnbull's son and that sort of stuff come out recently and say that he was offered and that sort of stuff a position on a firm and that type of thing. You've also got Dutton, that sort of stuff, throwing rocks, saying it was probably a former Labor member, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, yeah. Dutton came out and said, I bet you it was a Labor guy.
Yeah, exactly. Which I don't think you could actually say that for certain that it wasn't actually a Labor guy.
Yeah.
It might well have been a Labor guy, but you can't be certain of that.
Particularly when Turnbull's son was approached.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, he's probably a Labor guy now.
Sorry?
He probably is a Labor guy now, given the state of the Liberal Party. The Turnbull son is probably a Labor guy. But look, I've got a theory.
Yeah?
The reason why he didn't give any details and he didn't name the politician was because there wasn't enough there to actually get people worried.
No.
And that he's really head of ASIO comes out and says all this. Oh, there's this major operation, can't tell anything about it. There's politician involved, can't tell you anything about it. Probably a very minor matter that you'd think, well, there's no major security risk there, no major damage to Australia. Oh, it wouldn't surprise me if it was a very lightweight issue and one of his reasons for not revealing it is because he's trying to beat up the importance of and need for ASIO. Now, using that new website that I talked about, which was the web page archive one, I managed to look at this afternoon a Sydney Morning Herald article, and in that they say that China's leading spy agency was revealed as the organisation. In an exclusive interview with this masthead and 60 Minutes, ASIO Director General Mike Burgess told them it was China, but he hit back at calls for him to identify the traitorous ex-politician. So in his sort of initial statement, Burgess referred to this A-team, and in his meeting with the masthead, the Sydney Morning Herald, he revealed that this A-team was China's Ministry of State Security, MSS. In that same article, they referred to an Alan Joske, J-O-S-K-E, a leading Australian scholar on Chinese intelligence. And he says that China's spy agency has decades of expertise operating around Australia. Historically, its operations have been hidden through a veneer of academic or business relationships, and it's difficult to systematically root them out. Once an Australian is inside China, they're on MSS home turf, where it has the greatest ability to use its coercive powers and surveillance capability. And as an example, he cited a small Australian media delegation to China last year as part of a long-standing exchange program where the group met with Chinese journalists and foreign affairs analysts. And Joske says one of those analysts was a spy officer. Bernard Keane, writing in Crikey, said, well, he was on that trip as one of the media people. And basically, it was just a media trip. And yes, they were in China. And he said he expects that he would have met more than one person who was a spy. He expects he would have met scores of them.
Mm.
And Of course he was getting a party line, but it was still an interesting and worthwhile experience. And he says that, you know, he's no lover of China. What does he say here? I was part of the delegation, and I'm somewhat puzzled by Mackenzie and Josky's claim. Said he would have been having contact with lots of spies, he assumes. And he said this was when they were just the first group of Australian journalists allowed to come to China since the pandemic. And he said, did it change our minds on China? I suspect not. Certainly in my case, I still think it's a monstrous regime. So Bernard Keane and Crikey isn't a China lover. But he just makes the point, it's just a delegation goes, meets people, and that's an example used in a fear-mongering article in the Sydney Morning Herald as an example of the coercive efforts by the Chinese spy agency. The delegations are taken over. Honestly, when you read the Sydney Morning Herald article, it does all seem like a bit of a beat up over nothing. And the fact that this ASIO head hasn't given any specifics about who the politician is and what he revealed. What do you think the worst case could be, Scott? Imagine what could a regular politician, let's just say not a minister, but any other politician, what secret could they reveal that would be worthwhile to China that they didn't already know?
That's the whole point. You know, we are awash with foreign agents over here in this country. You know, it's just that China's the latest boogeyman. Mm. Now, you know, everything that happens over here, the Yanks know about, the British know about, the Kiwis know about, the Canadians know about. The Indians probably over here finding out stuff too. Yeah. It's just it is what it is. You know, it's
what do you think they'd say? Oh, we now have these weapons. Well, it's pretty public knowledge in the agencies as to what weapons we're buying from America.
Yeah.
What the capabilities of these weapons are, XYZ. Well, they already know the capability of these weapons.
So they'd work out.
What would an average politician know of any significant detail that would be advantageous to a foreign spy agency?
No, it's probably all just a media beat up that Burgess was carrying on with. You know, he said that, you know, if you just listen to the language, a traitorous former MP.
Yes.
You know, well, who was he treasonous with? What did he actually hand over and that sort of stuff? And then that would be the end of it.
Yes.
Because I honestly believe that if they actually did find out what he actually handed over, he would be sitting there saying, and, you know.
I think that's my theory that I'm working on. So yeah, that's the spy agency matter, and we'll see what comes of that down the track. Scott Morrison has departed the room, finally.
Yeah, finally, yeah.
And let me just see what his comments were. This is the calibre of part of his farewell. Quoting Scott Morrison here. We should be careful about diminishing the influence and voice of Judeo-Christian faith in our Western society. This was in an interview with a friendly journalist. As doing so risks our society drifting into a valueless void. It's all about respecting each other's human dignity through our creation, by God's hand, in God's image, for God's glory, where each human life is eternally valued, is unique, is worthy, is loved and capable. Thank Christ we don't have to listen to that prick anymore, Scott.
Mm. He was an absolute tool, wasn't he?
Mm. I don't think Christ had anything to do with that.
Joe, you're sounding better. Whatever you did.
I'm on my 5G connection.
Okay, that's it.
Right.
Why weren't you on that before? What were you on before? Oh, that's your phone, your 5G.
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
I was on my fibre before.
There you go. Well, you're coming through beautifully now, Joe.
Okay.
Feel free to contribute.
Okay.
anything you want to bite into about what we said before?
No. I was merely saying that maybe it was a former member of parliament who was taking trips to Southeast Asia and then ended up getting married over there.
Yeah, but Southeast Asian countries are our allies. So,
and again, what could he possibly have revealed of any significance other than the location of some fun houses or something? Who knows? Mm. But Hardacre, David Hardacre was writing in Crikey a lot about Morrison and the Pentecostal movement and whatnot. And, you know, he's commenting on the departure of Morrison and really with Morrison and together with Brian Houston sort of having a major influence by Pentecostals on Australian society. And he said that throughout Morrison's time in office, the question of the influence of religion on his politics has been largely off the table, not a question to be asked in polite company. I like to think that we're not guilty of that. If there's one thing that this podcast does is ask what is the religious faith of politicians and then start theorising about whether that's had an effect on their politics. And not enough people have done it. And the sort of gist, is it gist or gist? I always get this wrong.
You say the gist, isn't it?
Gist. The gist of the article is that maybe we should be examining people's religious belief if we're trying to understand what they're doing.
Yeah, see, you've got it right there, Trevor. You know, you were the first.
Yeah. So
I do think that Scott Morrison is a particular brand of religious he's very forthright in his religion.
Mm.
He actually honestly believes all that crap that is in Revelations is only just around the corner, you know, and that is a very frightening thing that you can actually, if someone truly believes all that sort of nonsense and they're actually making plans and that sort of stuff, then that possibly explains why he walked into Parliament that day with a hunk of coal in his hand.
Yes. So there were some very specific things like the push to move the Australian embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and also pledging multi-million-dollar grant to a Pentecostal rehab centre in Perth, which later had to close down because of its harsh religious-based treatments, such as casting out demons. So there's a few specific things like that. But when you're looking at the secret portfolios that Morrison took and trying to understand the mentality of somebody who would do that, Tim Costello was saying that the Pentecostal style of leadership can cast some light on that. And he says that the Pentecostal model is that God has blessed me and my decisions. The theology is that God anoints the leader, that the leader casts the vision, and in the governance sense, the people have to be loyal to that vision, which he says is different to the Baptist model where decisions are taken by church congregations, which makes for slower and more difficult decision-making process. So the Pentecostal model has this anointed leader where everyone is supposed to be loyal to them. And that would be some explanation for Morrison's secret ministries. So anyway, it doesn't explain all of it, but would be part of it.
It explains a fair amount of it. It doesn't explain everything, but explains a lot about it.
Yes. And then, of course, there's just this whole prosperity gospel thing, which is really if you're not wealthy and doing well, you're clearly not in God's favour. So it's an indication you're not in God's favour, so you must be doing something wrong and you therefore deserve it to some extent. That's kind of what happened to explain robo debt and stuff like that, where there was just the other aspect of his personality. So, yeah, Scott Morrison heading off into the sunset, thank goodness. So,
bye, Scott.
Yeah. Now, more headlines. So last couple of weeks I've been referring to headlines in particular, I think, in relation to Gaza that are kind of misleading. And I was listening to something. I think it might have been the Geopolitical Economy Report. Geopolitical Report. Anyway, there was like this study done of people reading news sources, and essentially a significant number maybe it was 40, 50% of people, just read the headline and don't go any further. Would that make sense to you, Scott?
Yeah, it does. You know, it's one of those things. If I've got a hell of a lot on and all that sort of stuff, I do look at the headlines. I then didn't do the read the first couple of paragraphs, then move on.
Mm. So I'm about to read some headlines, and okay, deep within the body of the article, there might have been more damning words written about Israel's actions, but just examining the headlines and bearing in mind that people quite often just read the headline, it's interesting to look at some of the differences. So you guys would be aware of the flour massacre, where there was this flour being distributed, flour, F-L-O-U-R, in Gaza, and a lot of people milling around and, you know, scrambling for flour because they're starving, and Israeli troops shot them.
Mm.
So the different headlines describing that, Sydney Morning Herald, dozens killed while waiting for food aid, Gaza health authorities say. So they were killed while waiting for food aid, just by some mysterious action, and then also downplayed because it's Gaza health authorities say, meaning a subtle inference, you know, if you can believe what they say. So that was Sydney Morning Herald. Sydney Morning Herald again, more than 100 killed as troops fire on Palestinians seeking food. No mention of who those troops actually were. This was a straight-up one from the Courier Mail that I saw. Israeli troops shoot Gazans scrambling for food. Well, that's pretty much telling it as it was. And that's a far more compelling image than the other two that I just read out. New York Times, as hungry Gazans crowd an aid convoy, a crush of bodies, Israeli gunshots and chaos. So not really blaming the Israelis for it, just one of the incidents that happened amongst many. And what was this one here? ABC News. I reckon the ABC's been quite poor on the whole Gaza thing. ABC News. Gaza authorities say, again, the influence, if you can believe them, Israeli troops open fire near aid truck. IDF says trampling happened. Seems like people, yes, were trampled, running away from the gunfire that was opened up on them. The BBC, more than 100 die in crowd near Gaza aid convoy. Doesn't mention how or why. They just died in a crowd.
Mm.
The Cradle is a place I've been going to lately, this website. Israeli troops gunned down thousands of Palestinians awaiting aid in North Gaza. So that was kind of like the Courier Mail one. So it's just an example of how these organisations, just through their headlines, are manipulating people's thoughts on the same set of facts, depending how it's worded. So, you know, none of that you would say was, you know, factually wrong, but it's all the subtle propaganda that Western media outlets are conducting. When people talk about propaganda in Russia and China and other totalitarian regimes, at least the people in those regimes know, okay, it's government propaganda. I'm not sure what to take into account here. But so many people.
Yeah, but, you know, of those two that you just mentioned, the BBC and the ABC, they're 100% government-owned.
Yes, yes.
You know, which is one of those things, you know. It's, I would actually hope that the ABC is actually genuinely independent, but it's beginning to look like they are pushing a government line for Israel.
And the New Zealand version of the ABC is really cracking down on internally on people referring to it as genocide.
Mm.
So they're really basically telling reporters and editors not to use that word.
Mm.
So Caitlin Johnson wrote a good article on it, and let me read some of this. The Washington Post, chaotic aid delivery turns deadly as Israel Gazan officials tried blame. More than 100 killed as crowd waits for aid, Hamas-run health ministry says. That was another BBC headline. Yeah, bunch of examples there she goes into. And making some good points about the different treatment by the different organisations. And she's saying that the only good thing about what's happening in Gaza is that it's waking Westerners up to the fact that everything they've been told about their society, their media and their world is a lie. Not everything, Caitlin, but just I think it is, I think it's the headline or the name of this podcast episode, like Gaza is performing the role of Toto, who tugged at the curtain and Dorothy, the straw man and the tin man, looked behind the curtain and saw the wizard was something that they didn't think the wizard was. Mm. And that I think people can recognise the horror and the craziness of the Gaza situation and look at, well, the treatment by the media of it, and just I think it's coming more obvious to people, that sort of propaganda, and maybe more obvious to people just the double standards that are being levied, where if any other country other than Israel was doing this, clearly the world would be up in arms and doing far more to stop it than what they are. I think this Gaza situation is so bad. It's, what do you think? Is it a sort of a bit of a tipping point maybe in people's understanding of how the world works and the West favours Western allies, and it's a hypocritical double standard?
I don't think it's actually that sort of tipping point. I think it is probably a tipping point for the way people perceive Israel right now.
Right.
I think that people are actually starting to turn away from Israel, and they are starting to cling on to those slogans and that sort of stuff that the Palestinians have always said.
Mm.
You know, from the river to the sea, Palestine should be free.
Mm.
Fair enough. What are you going to do with the Jews that are there? You know, you know, it's one of those things. I think that a terrible mistake was made in 1948, and you've just got to live with the consequences now. So, but
or die with the consequences.
Well, some people, exactly. Yeah. It could die with the consequences too. It's one of those things, you know. I think we've examined the whole start of the war and everything like that ad infinitum, so there's probably no point in me rehashing that. But
yeah, I think we mentioned a while ago as well, just the reference to an apartheid state.
Yeah, it is. Apartheid state, you know.
And I think that is resonating with people as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's something we all kind of remember.
Mm. You know? Yeah. So what could Australia do? We make parts for F-35 bombers. Did you know that?
Mm.
I didn't know that.
And we're selling parts to Israel and all that sort of stuff that are presumably being used in the Israeli war machine to level Gaza.
Yes. So we're selling parts for F-35 machines that are then being used to commit human rights atrocities. And so the proposition from people is that we should stop supplying military spare parts to Israel. And just if you want to know how much we have been, according to this article, so in Michael West Media wrote that over 70 Australian companies supply parts and maintenance to F-35 bombers. Every F-35 contains some Australian parts. And a Senate hearing in October 2023 revealed Australia had approved 322 permits for defence goods to be exported to Israel since 2017. So 322 permits. And a similar hearing in February revealed that two approvals have been made since the 7th of October incident. So since 7th of October, there's been two approvals for defence goods to be exported to Israel. And Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade figures show that there's been some $10 million in arms and ammunition sales to Israel in the past 5 years. Turns out we sell ammunition as well. And what we've got is Penny Wong says, we're not exporting arms to Israel.
Well, she's clearly wrong there.
Well, what she's being sneaky because it depends how you measure arms. So another article from Michael West shows that there's a UN register of conventional arms. And what that's interested in is accounting for arms that are moved around the world. And they don't count spare parts because there would be a lot of double counting of ammunition if you were counting parts. So they're more into counting completed items. And so Penny Wong would be saying that we're not sending completed items, but ignoring the fact that we're sending vital parts. And so that's the sort of shit that we would have expected from the Morrison government, but we're getting it from this Albanese government and Penny Wong, this sort of dishonest.
I'd expect it from Labor, to be honest.
Yeah. I had hopes of better, but we're not getting it. So yeah, in the Netherlands, the Dutch, the appeals court ordered the government to stop the export of F-35 bomber parts to Israel, citing the clear risk that it was being used for war crimes. And we've signed treaties saying that there's an arms trade treaty where you agree that you're not going to sell arms if there's a risk of violations of human rights and international humanitarian law. You've got to be sure that's not going to happen with the parts that you're selling. It doesn't talk about completed items, that one. It talks about parts. And so, arguably, we're in breach of a treaty that we signed up to that says you don't sell parts to groups who are potentially committing human rights abuses, which would seem to be Israel. So, fair arguments in all of that. To what do you reckon, Scott? Should we stop selling F-35 spare parts, and should we cease further sales of ammunition to Israel? Get off that fence, Scott.
No, I don't think we should, because Israel's been found. No, they've been ordered to provide more information to the Dutch court over that South African case, though, haven't they?
Oh, the International Criminal, whatever, or
the ICJ
basically told them, stop doing a whole bunch of things and come back to us in a month and report to us about some other things. So
it's one of those things. It looks and smells like they are committing war crimes and that sort of stuff, but they haven't actually been. My understanding is the International Criminal Court hasn't actually completed its accusation of Israel and that sort of stuff and said that you've actually done that.
Yeah.
So I think unless you've got some sort of definite, well, you are committing these crimes and that sort of stuff, you've actually got to pull back and that sort of thing, then I don't believe that we should actually have to cease our export of those goods and that sort of stuff to Israel.
According to this treaty, all you need is an overriding risk that the weapons will be used in such breaches. So, okay,
well,
because you're not going to get criminal, you're not going to get court decisions on genocide. You know, these things take time, and you should be able to say there's a real risk here that there are human rights abuses being performed with these spare parts. While that risk is there, stop selling them. You know?
Yeah, but there's profits on the line. Come on.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know there's profits on the line.
Can I give you the case of the Netherlands? In making their findings, the court relied on evidence from the United Nations and Amnesty International showing that almost half the bombs dropped by Israel on Gaza are dumb bombs. Unguided bombs are generally not precise. And targets had included hospitals, schools, refugee camps, homes, markets, and religious buildings. Like, we know that's the case. It just requires human rights international human and international humanitarian law, just breaches of that. You don't need genocide, just breaches of international humanitarian law. If they haven't, it's a clear risk that that's what's going to happen with the parts that we send, surely. What do we sign these treaties for if we're not going to...
I have no idea what the parts are.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't matter. It's a part that helps an F-35
fly.
And the F-35 is dropping the bombs.
If it's for an ejector seat.
Right.
If it's...
They can't fly it without it. Great. Like, if it's an ejector seat, okay, we can't fly the plane. So without an ejector seat, great. That stops them bombing. I don't see how that makes a difference, Joe, but anyway.
Yeah.
They've all gone silent in the chat room. We're down to three people anyway. So,
I think that...
You're okay with us then, Scott?
No, it's one of those things. I don't think we should be selling them any weapons right now. Not until they've actually agreed to a ceasefire and that sort of thing. And once they actually agree to a ceasefire, then they can pull out and then we can then open the floodgates and start selling weapons to them again.
The Houthis are showing us up. Yeah.
Well, the Houthis have actually, they've scored a hit. There is a ship that has gone down in the Red Sea.
Right. I didn't see that one.
Yeah, isn't it some, it's going to be a disaster for the environment.
Yeah, and it's also a ship that had nothing to do with Israel or the United States or Europe. It was flagged under a country whose name escapes me.
According to who?
I don't know. Whatever report I was listening to.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's one of those things. I don't think that they're all sweetness and light, Trevor.
No, I don't think they are either.
Yeah.
But anyway, hey, you heard about the guy who was an American serviceman who set himself on fire outside the Israeli embassy?
Yes.
Really?
In Washington?
Self-immolated.
Yes, as a form of protest about America's involvement in the whole Gaza crisis. You heard about that, Scott?
No, and it's when I read the email that you sent out yesterday.
Yeah. Independent journalist Talia Janes reports she was able to obtain footage of the incident, and as he was setting himself on fire, saying he will no longer be complicit in genocide and yelling "Free Palestine." So, according to this person, and I'm pretty sure it was confirmed in other people, a police officer showed up, pointing a gun at the man's burning body. And as Caitlin Johnson says, I guess that's just what American cops do when they aren't sure what to do. Someone who was actually trying to save the man reportedly yelled, "I don't need guns, I need fire extinguishers." And according to Caitlin Johnson, this just might be the most American thing I've ever heard of. You simply cannot fit more America into a single incident than a man dying of a horrifying death in protest of war crimes while a first responder screams at cops to stop pointing their guns at him and to go get fire extinguishers. If you were to pick a single moment in history to sum up the essence and expression of the US empire, that would be it. Yeah.
A friend of mine in Florida said there was a shooting near him recently. The police had arrested a guy, got him in cuffs in the back of the car, and an acorn fell on the car.
Yeah.
So they both pulled their weapons and emptied the full clip of ammunition into the car. None of the bullets hit the guy.
Wow.
So both of them would have shot, I don't know, 8 to 9 rounds each, and none of them managed to hit a guy who was in handcuffs in the back seat.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. I didn't hear. I heard that story too. I thought to myself, Jesus Christ! You know, they've got some very bad shots on their cops.
Trigger happy and bad shots.
Another black mark against the Albanese government and our treasurer Jim Chalmers, because There's currently a provision in the Act that governs the Reserve Bank that gives the government a form of reserve powers which it can be used in extreme circumstances, and there's a complex process that can happen when the Treasurer and the bank are unable to reach agreement, whereby the Treasurer of the day, the elected Treasurer, Minister, can tell the Reserve Bank what to do. And it's a complicated process and it's to be used in extreme circumstances. And Chalmers is proposing to get rid of that ability so that a Treasurer cannot use that emergency power to tell the unelected Reserve Bank what to do.
Yeah, because he's upholding the principle of an independent Reserve Bank.
But the section's already there. The power's there. It's been there.
I know
there.
The power's there. And lots of
but
stuff.
What about democracy? What about
Okay, but if you got that power there and that sort of stuff, I don't believe they should bother removing it.
Yes.
However,
it's there.
If you had a position that, if we went back to the way it was prior to when the Reserve Bank didn't actually set the interest rates, but Keating did, then you could have a situation where a politician could actually say, no, we don't want the interest rates to rise because that'll fuck us over when it's the next election. So we've actually got to keep downward pressure on interest rates. That is probably my major concern with not having an independent Reserve Bank.
Let me just describe the process. If they're unable to reach agreement, the Treasurer and the Reserve Bank, the RBA has to give the Treasurer a statement about the difference of opinion. The Treasurer can then decide on the policy the bank must adopt following an order he arranged for the Governor-General to issue on the advice of the Executive Council. And the Treasurer has 15 sitting days to give each House of Parliament a copy of the policy order and other documents. So it's quite an open process that if our Treasurer and the Reserve Bank are at war over some issue, it's pretty obvious to everybody what it is.
Yeah. So you're not going to have a Treasurer and that sort of stuff intervening on the interest rates issue or anything like that.
Not on a 0.25% move, 0.5% move here or there or whatever. But in an emergency, he's the elected Treasurer.
I can understand that.
It's not like this Reserve Bank has got a great track record of knowing what it's doing, and where we've stood back and we've gone, thank goodness the Reserve Bank was in charge rather than the politicians, because they were ahead of the game. They saw things that the other guys didn't see. The change has been criticised as a mistake, or the proposed change hasn't happened yet, by former bank governors Ian McFarlane and Bernie Fraser. So former Reserve Bank governors have said, leave the power there. Plus Treasurers Paul Keating and Peter Costello have also come out and said, what are you doing? Leave it there. There was an inquiry into the Reserve Bank following its poor performance. And one of the recommendations in the inquiry was this. And Chalmers has said, oh, well, I'll adopt that measure. And people are going, just because it's a recommendation in an inquiry doesn't mean you have to adopt it. But good news, Scott, an alliance between the Greens and the Liberal parties. Now there's...
Yeah, that's, we'll keep that. We'll keep that under control. Yeah.
Did we ever expect to perform that sentence in this podcast?
We didn't.
An alliance between the Greens and the Liberal parties is going to force Jim Chalmers to keep a government power, is what The Guardian is saying. So strange bedfellows there.
Absolutely.
There was an article in Crikey that we should stop treating Paul Keating like a messiah. I've probably been guilty of that at times.
Well, I think he has got very much a messianic complex. He's right on AUKUS. I think he's right on that. But, everything else that he's been pushing is exactly the same crap he was still banging on with about in the 1990s. Like, if you actually listen to half of what he says, then you would be convinced that the superannuation laws and that sort of stuff were entirely his idea, you know, and everything else that's come from it is entirely his idea. Well, it wasn't entirely his idea. And, you know, the other stuff that he's actually talking about, and that sort of stuff just recently, was in 6 months ago, he's talking about, well, you know, if you don't spend it, the government should get it. You know, that is absolute garbage because it is
if you don't spend it, the government should get it. What was this? In relation to what?
In relation to superannuation.
Oh.
Well, so when you die.
Yeah, the government should get it rather than you being able to leave it behind or any of your family.
King said that.
Yeah.
One of his policies apparently recently, something that Keating says is, there's an issue that all societies should have of how far a person's conscientious efforts and wealth should be delivered to the state. Once you start getting the top rate over, in my opinion, 39%, it becomes confiscatory. And when they become confiscatory, you lose all that impetus to make a dollar and do clever things. He's running the argument that a tax rate above 39%, rich people are going to just stop working and stop acquiring wealth because
I think that's a load of crap. You know, it's one of those things, like Dad once told me that back in the 50s and 60s, you had tax rates that maxed out at 85% or 90%. Now, you had to earn a hell of a lot of money to actually pay that amount of tax. But, you know, I just think to myself that if someone is earning $10 or $12 million a year and you actually put up their income tax on their final, you know, if you let them earn up to $1 million a year and that sort of stuff, then after that you start increasing the tax rates, then I just think to myself that no one's going to turn their nose up on an extra $2 million a year if they only get $200,000 of that because the other 90% of it's gone to the Commonwealth.
According to the writer in this Crikey article, this proposal by Keating isn't backed by economic research. So economist Thomas Piketty famously wrote Capital, Emmanuel Sayers and Stephanie Stancheva estimate that a socially optimal top tax rate could be as high as 83%. And Piketty's mentor, Tony Atkinson, estimated 65%. Sayers previously estimated 73%. So lots of well-known economists put the figure a lot higher than Keating's 39%, at which time people will stop doing anything because they're being taxed.
Do you honestly think that anybody is going to pay the top rate of tax anyway? Right. If you're that rich, you can afford accountants to hide it away.
Yeah, it's difficult to hide. Yeah. What are we at? We've been going an hour and a quarter. I was tempted to do this Galloway thing, but it's quite lengthy. I might save it for next week. A guy called George Galloway. We'll talk about him next week and his rhetorical style.
That my UK friends were very upset that he won.
Yes. He's got a colourful history and background.
Did he win for the Labour Party or did he win for the Conservatives?
The Workers' Party. So he's previously been a member of one of the major parties, but he's formed a workers' party. So there was a by-election and he beat all comers and won as his workers' party candidate. Now, it was in an electorate with a high Muslim population and he is a very big advocate on anti-Zionism and pro-Palestine and a long history of pro-Libya, pro-Hezbollah, in their fight against Israeli aggression on the border. So
the comment I see is another Putin-funded stooge in the British political system.
Yes.
Was the comment
on Reddit?
No. This was in a private forum.
Yeah. So, there'd be lots of... If you scratch the surface with this guy, there would be lots of stuff that would be, I'm sure, a little bit on the crazy side.
Oh, God, yeah.
But we're talking about him now. Let's play the clip. It's 7 minutes. People are going to be okay with a 7-minute clip. This is a long-form podcast. It's got, you don't have to go anywhere. You got 10 minutes. Okay. Ignore the content of his policies, but just in a Keating-esque approach to dealing with journalists. Loved what this guy's approach was. So here we go, a bit of Galloway on how to deal with the media. Yeah, I'll play this.
I'm standing here at George Galloway's campaign headquarters. George Galloway, did you just watch the Prime Minister's speech?
I didn't watch it, but I understood the first part of it related to the Rochdale by-election.
The Prime Minister has just said that the election of you to Parliament is beyond horrifying. What do you say to that?
Well, I can understand how disappointed he is about the by-election. The Conservative Party, which is the government of the country, was crushed, not just by me, but by an independent candidate that no one had ever heard of before outside of Rochdale. So it was a disastrous night for the Conservatives and a disastrous night for Labour. I got more votes than Labour and the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats and the Reform Party put together, which adds up to a pretty crushing rejection of the two-party system. So I understand why he's alarmed.
I want you to address some of the specifics that the Prime Minister said about you this evening. He said that you backed Hezbollah. Is that true?
I don't know what that means, backed Hezbollah. I oppose Israel's occupation of Lebanon, and I respect the right of people in occupied territory to resist their occupier. And I've done so since Hezbollah was formed and Israel occupied much of Lebanon, right up to the Litani River, regularly bombing Beirut and so on. So I'm not sure what business that is of his. Because, you see,
Hezbollah are a terrorist organisation.
Actually, they're part of the government of Lebanon, a country with which we have sovereign diplomatic relations. I had this debate with Sky's Anna Botting in 2006. It's quite an epic clip. You should watch it. More than 100 million people have. They said all these things about me in the by-election. And in the by-election, it was them that got crushed in the democratic process. So I'm not sure why he would reheat it. Now,
the Prime Minister is saying
talk
that
as
you
if
are
this is God. We're talking about little Rishi Sunak in the fag end of his prime ministership. Don't talk to me as if he's come down from the mount with tablets of stone. The things that he says are somehow meant to awe me. They may awe you, they don't awe me.
A lot of people have just watched what the Prime Minister said. This is your opportunity to respond to what he said.
Well,
he says that there are forces here at home trying to tear us apart. He is implying you are a divisive figure.
Well,
you have run an election campaign that has tried to appeal, particularly, one section of the community.
Who won the election? Me or Rishi Sunak? I've got the democratic mandate here, not Rishi Sunak. He didn't even come second. He was lucky to come third. So don't put to me statements made by Rishi Sunak as if I'm supposed to be impressed by them. He don't impress me much.
We at Sky have spent some time today on the streets of Rochdale, and there are people who say that they feel intimidated by people like you and the people that have supported you.
They have pointed out
that you have concentrated your campaign on foreign affairs, and they worry that Rochdale will not be the winner.
That's my answer to you. I was just elected with a thumping majority by the electorate in Rochdale. That's all that matters to me.
So why are there people in the streets of Rochdale today worried?
Well, people voted yesterday, and they voted for me. Why is that difficult for you to grasp?
Why are there people on the streets worried?
There may be people who didn't vote for me who are worried, but the majority, the thumping majority, voted for me. I've got the mandate, and I'm going to the House of Commons with it.
And it's a mandate, you think, to do what? Because there are people that listen to what you say, what you say about whether or not Israel has a right to exist, what you say about what many Jewish people think are threatening slogans.
We had this conversation last night. Why are you reheating it?
Because in the light of the Prime Minister's
statement... Don't keep telling me about the Prime Minister as if he was Moses.
Do you not respect the Prime Minister?
Do I respect the Prime Minister? I despise the Prime Minister. And guess what? Guess what? Millions and millions and millions of people in this country despise the Prime Minister. I don't respect the Prime Minister at all.
What are you planning to do next week when you arrive in Parliament?
Well, I'm meeting the Speaker on Monday morning, and then I'll be introduced and sworn in. I'll be escorted by the Right Honourable David Davis MP, former Deputy Leader of the Conservative Party. I don't know why he would do that if he thought I was the kind of man you're clearly implying that I am. David Davis is one of the great parliamentarians of today and this age, and I'll be taking my seat in the House of Commons and speaking for the people of Rochdale. That's what I was elected to do.
And what is your message also to Keir Starmer?
My message to Keir Starmer is that the skids are under you in scores of Labour seats up and down the country, because you've lost the trust, you've lost the confidence of millions of your traditional loyal voters.
Now, we have now had an election where two of the candidates have alleged intimidation. The Prime Minister referenced that intimidation in his address
you
on the steps
referring
of
to the Prime Minister as if that's supposed to impress me. The Prime Minister is the Prime Minister is a rather diminutive, diminished and degraded politician. He made a party political statement. I don't care about Rishi Sunak's attitude. What I care about is that the returning officer, a man of unimpeachable integrity, I'm sure you'll agree, declared it a free and fair election, and me as the winner, and Rishi Sunak as one of the crushed two big parties in the state.
So why are two candidates?
You keep repeating the same questions to me because I have other people to talk to. So let's make this the last one, shall we?
We got a party to go with.
Allegations of intimidation. Allegations that your supporters intimidated other candidates.
What times you've said that? The returning officer declared it last night. You were there as a free and fair election, and me as the winner.
And the Electoral Commission today have said that they're going to look and talk to the parties.
You have to just suck it up. I won the election.
George Galloway, thank you very much indeed.
Well, what did you think of his rhetorical style, Scott?
Well, it was very forthright, wasn't it? And I also, I did like his final line there. He says, you're just going to have to suck it up.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those things, like he said that Keir Starmer's got the skids under him and all that sort of stuff in seats up and down the country. I don't know whether or not that's true, but clearly Britain's in a hell of a mess right now.
Oh, I would imagine it must be a bit of a worry that that this third party has won this seat. So,
well, you know, it was only one seat, and it was only in a by-election. So, you know, it's one of those things that they don't have a compulsory vote over there. They've got a number of people that would have stayed home and all that type of thing.
Mm.
I'm not sure that you could actually, you know, if it was a compulsory ballot like we have here, then you could actually link something to it, you think to yourself, Jesus Christ, these guys have come from nowhere. So they've actually come out and they've pinched it from us.
Mm.
It's one of those things. I don't know how it's going to turn out with the general election. When is the general election due? It's next year, isn't it, Joe?
It's soonish.
Soonish. This year or next year?
I don't know. Not sure.
Okay.
Yeah. I thought it was a ways off yet, but like next year, I thought. But anyway, it was sort of Keating-esque in that he just was on the attack on the journalist. Just wasn't taking shit and was saying, what you're really saying is this and why and your inference is this and the reality is this. And without beating around the bush, here's a really direct answer to what you were saying. And you're an idiot for keep asking the question. I wish there was more of it.
The answer is no later than 28th of Jan 2025.
There right, we go. Okay. Right, thank you. So in that interview, he refers to an interview that he had with what was the lady's name? Anna Botting. I've got a recording of that. I think on the audio version of this podcast, I'll tack it on to the end if you like that. If you don't like it, just quit the podcast. So when we say our farewells, I'm just going to throw that on at the end for people who are listening to the audio version of this, where he talks about Lebanon and Hezbollah and with this tackles this journalist over her questioning on that.
So one of his former wives was a Palestinian, for context.
I think he's got like four former wives and
yes.
like 10 and two, kids.
Two,
and
two of them at least are Muslims.
Yeah. And, you know, I think he's nearly 16. I think he's got like a five-year-old or something like that. His personal life to me sounds a shambles. But
yeah.
hey, it's not about his policies and about
nope.
him himself. It's more about having the ability to think on your feet and to just not put up with shitty questions and deal with things directly that I found refreshing. And I know Keating was criticised for his performance at the press club when he was talking about AUKUS because of the way he just minced up a few journalists. But honestly, I think it just needs to be more of it. Yeah. So, all right. Well, that's enough of that. You'll get that other interview. I'll tag it on the end of the audio. Well, we go, dear listener, a bit of a longer episode to make up for not being around last week. So hope you enjoyed it. We'll talk to you next week. Bye for now.
And it's a good night from me.
And it's a good night from him.
Good night.
Joining me now is a man not known for sitting on the fence. He passionately opposed the invasion of Iraq, and now he feels that Hezbollah is justified in attacking Israel. The Respect MP for Bethnal Green is in our central London studio. A very good evening, a good morning rather, to you, Mr. Galloway. How do you justify your support for Hezbollah and its leader, Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah?
A preposterous way to introduce an item, and what a preposterous first question. 24 years ago, on the day my daughter was born, and I've just celebrated her 24th birthday, I had to dash to the maternity hospital to see her given birth from a mass demonstration in London against the Israeli invasion and occupation of Lebanon. Israel has been invading and occupying Lebanon all of my 24-year-old daughter's life. The Hezbollah are a part of the Lebanese national resistance who are trying to drive, having successfully driven most Israelis from their land in 2000, Israel from the rest of their land, and to get back those thousands of Lebanese prisoners who were kidnapped by Israel under the terms of their illegal occupation of Lebanon. It's Israel that's invading Lebanon. It's Israel that's attacking Lebanon, not Lebanon that's attacking Israel. You've just been carrying a report of 10 Israeli soldiers on the border getting ready to invade Lebanon, and you ask us to mourn that operation as if it were some kind of war crime. Israel is invading Lebanon and has killed 30 times more Lebanese civilians than have died in Israel. So it's you who should be justifying the evident bias which is written on every line on your face and is in every nuance of your voice and is loaded in every question that you ask.
Right. You put your finger on the button, though, didn't you, when you said that Hezbollah was set up back in the 1980s in order to remove every Israeli soldier from Lebanese soil. As you said, it achieved that in 2000.
No, it didn't.
This is a setback.
No, it didn't. It didn't. This is a key point that you're concealing from your viewers. Israel was forced out of most of the south of Lebanon in 2000. It still occupies a part of Lebanon since 2000.
The Shebaa Farms area, which is subject to this latest UN draft resolution.
Thousands of Lebanese prisoners have been kidnapped by Israel. Hezbollah and the
Lebanese
government
want them to be released. I spoke just a moment ago to the Israeli Foreign Ministry spokesman, who said that the three Lebanese who have been captured, perhaps you'd like to use that word, have been
before
a court of law.
Oh, please, have a slightly longer memory than 4 weeks I'm talking about the thousands of prisoners taken during the 18 years of Israeli occupation, illegal occupation of South Lebanon. These are the prisoners that have to be released in exchange for the Israeli soldiers that were captured at the beginning of this wave of the crisis.
Can I ask you about a report that's in today's Sunday Telegraph, which showed that Iran has given Hezbollah long-range missiles capable of targeting any part of Israel? Iran, according to this Iranian MP who helped found Hezbollah, has also said that Iran has given the authorization to target Tel Aviv. Can you blame Israel for wanting to destroy those missiles?
This is preposterous. America has given Israel missiles that can target not just every city in Lebanon, but every city in the Arab and Muslim world, including Iran. Why should America be allowed to give long-range missiles to Israel, including hundreds of nuclear missiles, but Iran
because
is not
given
allowed
it to a
give
terrorist
missiles?
Organization.
But they're not a terrorist organization. Only in the mind of Rupert Murdoch's Sky and the Times and the Sun and the News of the World.
I'm going to stop
not
you there, Mr. Galloway.
Organization.
Prescribed
it's
terrorist organizations.
Terrorist.
One man's terrorist
See,
is another man's freedom fighter. We know that perfectly well. In most people's eyes, they are deemed to be.
No,
they had a choice, didn't they? Let's understand this. They had a choice, like the IRA.
No,
to
they're nothing
take
to do
on
with
politics.
The IRA. Listen, Anna.
I'm saying they had a choice
to
absorb the idea of politics. They've got two Hezbollah cabinet ministers.
Anna, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. You are totally wrong in saying that in most people's eyes, Hezbollah are terrorists. In most people's eyes, Israel is a terrorist state. It's the fact that you cannot comprehend that fact that leads to the bias which runs through all of your reporting and every question that you've asked me in this interview.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you one question? I was relating to the IRA and Sinn Féin. They have decided to embrace politics. Hezbollah had the chance to embrace politics. They've already got two cabinet ministers. They're well respected
in
the South.
In politics. They are
That's what I'm
the
saying. If you listen to me, I'm saying they've got two cabinet ministers already. They had a chance to do that. Why did they need to capture and kill Israeli soldiers on the border? Surely that sets back
because
their ambitions to be a political force inside a democratic Lebanon.
Look, because Israel occupies their country and holds thousands of their compatriots as kidnapped hostages in their dungeons. It's really very simple, except if you think only in a clock that goes back 4 weeks. If you know, and you're old enough to know better, that this origins of this conflict are not 4 weeks or 4 years or 14 years, but are decades old. You want people to think that the crisis started when the clock started ticking on Sky News.
No,
Unfortunately, the people in Lebanon know differently.
I want to ask you one final question. Do you think that the 4 weeks that we've seen, as you mentioned, the 26 days of this crisis, has set back Hezbollah's ambitions? Not only are Israeli soldiers now over the border. Let me finish. Would you mind letting me finish, please? Not only are Israeli soldiers over the border in sizable numbers, but also their claims to be a good political organization to help a democratic Lebanese government with the Syrians who've also now left an independent state, that has also come to blows as well.
What a silly question. What a silly person you are. Hezbollah is winning the war. You can see it on the other half of the screen. Hezbollah is more popular today.
That was not my question.
Hezbollah is more popular today in Lebanon amongst Christians, amongst Sunnis, amongst Shiites, amongst all Arabs, amongst all Muslims, than it has ever been. It's Israel who's lost the war, and Bush and Blair, for politically organizing the war, who've lost politically. This is a defeat for Bush and Blair and Israel. Everybody but you can see it.
Let me separate out that question then. Is it a setback, given that Hezbollah was set up in order to get Israeli soldiers off Lebanese soil, that there are now more Israeli soldiers on Lebanese soil than there were 26 days ago?
Well, they seem to be getting a bloody good hiding on the other half of the screen that I'm watching. Maybe you can't see it, but I'm watching them getting a bloody good hiding in the war. So if that's a success, I'm not sure what a failure would look like. The reality is that this conflict will go on. The United Nations resolution solves nothing, gives Lebanon nothing, gives the prisoners in Israeli dungeons nothing. And as Anne Cluid, my erstwhile colleague, was just saying, Israel has just kidnapped even more Palestinian politicians, cabinet ministers, members of parliament, and thousands of others held in Israeli dungeons. And this war will continue until the overall settlement is reached. That settlement must mean Israeli withdrawal from all occupied territory that it currently holds since the war in 1967, the release of all political prisoners, and a state for the Palestinians with East Jerusalem as its capital. No justice, no peace. You're not going out of business as a newscaster in Jerusalem anytime soon, believe me.
Well, as usual, you have prompted a huge email response both for and against you, Mr. Galloway, so we'll leave it there. I have to say that some people might find it offensive when more families are mourning their dead to hear you say that it was a good hiding. So
you don't give a damn. You don't even know about the Palestinian families. You don't even know that they exist. Tell me the name of one member of the seven members of the same family slaughtered on the beach in Gaza by an Israeli warship. You don't even know their name, but you know the name of every Israeli soldier who's been taken prisoner in this conflict, because you believe, whether you know it or not, that Israeli blood is more valuable than the blood of Lebanese or Palestinians. That's the truth, and the discerning of your viewers already know it.